This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Patricia Arquette has been giving some remarkable performances playing complex characters. She's now starring in The Act. All 8 episodes are now streaming on Hulu. She won an Oscar for her performance in the 2014 film Boyhood. She won a Screen Actors Guild Award for her performance in the Showtime series Escape at Dannemora. In 2005, she won an Emmy for her starring role in the TV series Medium. Her siblings, including Rosanna and David Arquette, are actors too, as were her father, grandfather, and great-grandparents. Her new series, The Act, is based on the true story of Dee Dee Blanchard, who convinced her daughter and everyone they knew, including doctors, that the daughter was seriously ill. She was put on medications with bad side effects, fed through a feeding tube, subjected to unnecessary surgeries, and confined to a wheelchair. Having such a sick child, or allegedly sick child, got Blanchard attention, sympathy, and financial and housing help. When Blanchard's daughter, Gypsy Rose, was a teenager and figured out what was going on, she confided in her boyfriend. He murdered the mother in her bed. He was convicted of first-degree murder and is serving a life sentence. Gypsy Rose, the daughter, is serving a 10-year sentence for second-degree murder. Dee Dee Blanchard was posthumously diagnosed with Munchausen syndrome by proxy, a mental health disorder in which a person makes up or causes illness in a person under their care. Let's start with a scene in which Dee Dee Blanchard, played by Arquette, is talking with her new neighbors, played by Chloe Sevigny and Denitra Eiler. Blanchard is describing the many medical conditions her daughter has.
Some mandibular gland surgery. That's when she had her salivary glands removed because she was choking herself. She's got the epilepsy, paraplegia, a heart murmur. She can barely take anything by mouth. And, well, she's anemic.
Well, my kids got colds at the same time. I was like, Lord, take them. Please. Find them a good family. How the heck do you manage?
Oh, I sleep with one eye open, I suppose.
Me too. Can't watch them forever, though, right? Mel's a great mom, especially if you believe in tough love.
I just don't believe in spoiling them.
Of course.
You gotta teach them to fend for themselves as soon as they can walk.
Oh, Mel, everything is different with my Gypsy.
Of course. She ain't well.
She can't fend for herself. She'll never be able to. I have to do everything for her.
That must be a burden to carry.
Oh, it is. Thank God I'm good at it, though. Lord knows her daddy wasn't. I am the only one she has. If I wasn't around, who knows where she'd be.
Patricia Arquette, welcome back to Fresh Air. You give an amazing performance in The Act. The woman you are portraying is said to have had Munchausen by proxy. So what did you learn about that and about what happens in somebody's mind that would get them to make their child ill?
Well, I have to say that I think it's really understudied, and a lot is not known about it at this point. So part of my research was looking at what doctors were saying about Munchausen by proxy, and part of it was that oftentimes people, when they were children themselves, they were ill, and they got attention when they were ill, or love. That's how they got some of their needs met. So that's part of it. And that also the parents sometimes are using it for their own personal need for attention and or to raise money or a combination of those. But to go further with it, because I felt like it was really understudied, I looked at the mechanisms of toxic codependency. When somebody really feels that they have to do more and take care of people to such a level, and part of what's underneath there is they don't really feel that they have value enough in the world without doing all of that.
So before being in The Act, you co-starred in Escape at Dannemora, which is also based on a true story. It's based on the story of two male prisoners who escaped with the help of a civilian prison employee, Joyce Tilly Mitchell, who you played. And she ran the prison tailor shop where these two prisoners worked. As the story is portrayed in the film, both of the prisoners have sex with her. And it makes her feel sexy and desirable. to have sex with them, and she does favors for them, including eventually getting some of the tools that they need to escape. She was even supposed to drive the getaway car, but she had a panic attack at the last minute and failed to show up. I want to play a clip from the very end of the series when she's in jail, your character's in jail, on the day before her trial. She's with a guard, and she asks him if it's okay if she read the statement that she's written to read for the judge. So here's my guest, Patricia Arquette.
Hey, would you do me a favor? Would you listen to this and tell me what you think about it? It's for when I have to give my statement to the judge.
Okay.
Please allow me to start by saying how much remorse I have for everything that's happened with my part in Matt and Sweat's escape. I am 51 years old. This is by far the worst mistake I've ever made in my life. I not only let myself down, but my family. I love them more than life itself, Your Honor. None of this was ever my intentions. I'm not a bad person. I realize I need to be responsible for my actions, but I am hoping you will have mercy on me, Your Honor. My lawyer said I have to sound apologetic. Does that sound apologetic to you?
It's worth a shot. Hey, sometimes I like to throw an inmate a little party the night before she gets out of here. Something you'd be interested in? I'll be around. Think about it.
Well, it was a great performance.
Thank you.
How were you able to find something to relate to in her character? Like, what did you find you could pick up on and really understand?
Well, I felt like Tilly was a real triangulator. I saw that Tilly was getting her needs met by these three different men, like in a way, if she could put these three men together, she would have her ideal mate. She has this Lyle version when he's younger and who she thinks he's going to be as the savior and this man who's going to take care of her.
That's her husband.
Yes, that's her husband. But years later, we see that they've kind of fallen into this rut where she takes him for granted and she's become basically his caretaker in some kind of way. And there's a resentment about that. And then with Sweat, she has this very adolescent feeling, this excited feeling, like as if she was the cheerleader and he's the football player. And it's in a way innocent, but it's also weirdly maternal. But she just thinks he's really a good guy, and she has a huge crush on him, and she's crazy about him.
He's the prisoner then, played by Paul Dano.
Exactly. And then there's the third man, who is Benicio del Toro's character, Matt. And I felt like with him, he scares her, but he's also the most alpha male she's ever been with. And she's used to that. Being the alpha. So it's very strange for her to get thrown off her game. And there's a part of that that she really likes. And it's confusing to her. You know, she's living upstate New York. It's very cold. It's very harsh. You're working in this dangerous place, this prison. And she's in a marriage that at that moment, all she can see is coldness and where's her life going. And she's not feeling anything and she doesn't feel alive. And then all of these men are there, and suddenly I think she feels alive and seen and beautiful and sexual and desirable.
You had to physically transform yourself to play mm-hmm. Tilly. You gained 40 pounds. You wore prosthetic teeth. You had brown contact lenses. How does it feel to be in a different body when you're in a role? I mean, I feel weird when I put on clothes that make me uncomfortable and I don't feel quite myself. So, like, if you put on a body that's not yours, what does that feel like?
Well, conceptually, as a woman, I was really excited to explore this middle-aged woman being a sexual being and being really comfortable with her body and being sexual and, you know, in general, being comfortable with her body, even though later she wants to lose weight and do all this. But in her sexuality, being in her body completely, which is so different than me, because I've grown up in this Hollywood structure that's always telling you you're not right, no matter what the hell you look like. No matter how young and beautiful you are, you're not beautiful enough. And there's always something wrong with your body, and there's always something wrong with the way you look. So the idea to play someone, a middle-aged woman, who is unapologetic about her sexuality was very exciting to me. And some people in the business said, you don't have to really do that. Have them get you a fat suit. And I was like, I'm doing real love scenes, and I actually want to go for this. And I want people to see that, because I want to have that conversation. But in my real life, walking around for the many, many months, I think it was about a year, really, with all of this, even longer, it was hard. It was physically hard. And then people treated you really crappy.
Oh, tell me about how people treated you differently.
They would look at you like, oh, are you still working? Or, you know, or they would just ignore you. Honestly, there's people who didn't know who I was at all. And they would ignore you in line, or they would just push past you. You were kind of an invisible person, which I think helped me with that part. Her frustration of feeling invisible and wanting to be visible. But yeah, it's really weird. I think people do respond differently to people.
So this is a strange question to ask, but there's a lot of actors who, a lot of women who are actors who are already the weight that you had to become in order to play the role, and they probably very rarely get leading roles. Did you ever feel a twinge knowing that there were actresses who probably could have done the role without having to physically transform themselves and who don't get to work much? I know you're so into inclusivity and diversity, so I ask in that spirit, and I should preface this by saying, I love your work, and I'm so glad you got this role because you're fabulous in it. But still, I know it's a question.
No, I get it. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But the truth is also, this business is a really weird business, and that's not an excuse. I mean, you're right. There's not enough inclusivity, and there's not enough opportunities for people of all different shapes and sizes and races and gender identifications. And I think the business is worse for that, because they don't tell the stories of real human beings all the time. Having said that, Ben thought of me first, I think, because I physically look a little like Joyce or could.
This is Ben Stiller, then, who directed the series.
Yes, and we'd worked together before. But even with me on board, we couldn't get it greenlit. We had to keep waiting to get guys with bigger names than me.
You know, we were talking about gaining weight for a role, and I read that when you got the part, the leading role in the TV series Medium, it was not long after you'd given birth to your daughter, and you hadn't lost all of your baby weight yet, and they insisted that you needed to lose weight to start the series, and you declined to do that. So how did you make your case?
Well, I was having that conversation with one of the producers, and I said, no, this woman is in this marriage. She has 3 kids. I look perfectly normal, like a normal person. Why does she have to look like that? I mean, what is going on? She's not a part-time centerfold model. I don't understand. Why does she have to look like that? And then I ended up going to the show creator, Glenn Caron, and he was like, I think you look fine. I was like, okay. Then it settled.
You spent part of your childhood living on a commune with your parents. And this was a kind of spiritual community, if I understand correctly. Mm-hmm. These were followers of, or practitioners, or I'm not sure what you were to use, of Subud. And it's mm-hmm. a spiritual practice that was created in the 20s in Indonesia. I tried to go online and learn about it. I found it just a little vague and confusing because there isn't a specific practice mm-hmm. associated with it. So could you explain it a little bit?
Well, really, it's non-denominational. And there is actually a spiritual practice. I don't know how to explain it other than it's sort of like meditation, but with spontaneous movement. But it's really about kind of awakening this part of yourself so that you can have a direct connection to God and be connected to God even in the chaos of the world.
And were you raised to practice that?
When I was little, I mean, my parents were practicing that. We weren't told we had to practice anything. And actually, my mom was Jewish and my dad was Muslim. And I went to Catholic school and I wanted to be a nun. And at one point, my brother was Buddhist. And so my parents believed there was only one God and that really we all had the right as people to decide spiritually what our own paths were. But I do think that they derived a lot from their exercise, their spiritual exercise, and from being a part of Subud. And I do feel that it really grounded me and made me feel very close to God. Like I loved God and God loved me and I had a relationship with God. I still feel that.
How old were you when you moved there?
I think 4. We didn't live there that long. We lived mm-hmm. there for a few years, but it was a very pivotal time in my life, and it really, growing up in the country, in the wildness of the woods, playing outside and running around the base of the Appalachian Mountains, and seeing poverty and the South and racism, and it was really an intense way to grow up, and also, on another hand, very, very beautiful.
You mentioned your father was a Muslim, and he converted from Catholicism. Did he convert because of Subud?
He actually converted from Christianity. No, I mean, it's ridiculous. This story is crazy. My dad and my mom, I mean, their bond was really their spirituality and their politics and their minds. But at one point, my dad said, you know what, I'm going to convert to Judaism. And she said, oh, that's great. And so he went to go convert, and he got lost, and he came home, and he said, hey, I have something to tell you. I converted to Islam today. And she said, only you. You've got to be kidding me. Only you got lost and ended up in a mosque and converted to Islam. Okay. Okay.
Did you ever talk to him about that, about what happened at the mosque that made him change his mind?
I did a little bit. He said, you know, I got lost and I ended up at this mosque and I went in to ask for directions and I ended up talking to the imam and then, you know, we got into a really deep conversation about religion and it really felt right. And so that's what I did. I mean, we were raised to really respect all religions and all peaceful people, people that love God and even people that don't love God. We were raised to have a lot of tolerance for religious differences.
You've described your father as having been an alcoholic when you were young, and your mother as being prone to violence. So how does that fit with the serenity that they were reaching for?
Well, thank God they were reaching for that. I mean, I think that's a healthy instinct. And I do think they both improve throughout their lives. I mean, I think I would have a different concept about them if they hadn't really changed so much in their own lives. And
you saw them
tried
change
to take on. Yeah, my dad ended up getting sober, and my mom became a therapist and helped a lot of people. And I know she carried a lot of guilt around about her subconscious behavior and her expression of her anger when we were growing up.
Was that anger directed at you ever?
Well, yeah, all of us. All of us experienced it. And I think a lot of America experienced it. We also grew up in a time where, you know, it wasn't weird to be seeing people spanking kids in supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't talked about, it being a destructive thing as much.
So your film history goes back many years to the 80s. You grew up in a family with a history in acting. Your father, Louis Arquette, played J.D. Pickett in The Waltons. His father, your grandfather, was Cliff Arquette, who was known for his folksy character, Charlie Weaver, and he used to come on the late-night talk shows like The Jack Parr Show in character as Charlie Weaver and tell folksy stories. And then his father, your great-grandfather, was in vaudeville. What did you think of the acting life based on your family history?
My mom was really sad that I decided to be an actor because my principal at my school said, Patricia's so smart, she could be a doctor. She was like, why do you want to do this life? Because, you know, my dad was able to provide for us all, but it's really hard to make a living as an actor. And so there would be times where he'd be working a lot, times that he wouldn't be. And they'd be worried about paying their rent, or buying food, or, you know, being able to buy us new pair of shoes that someone had grown out of. All these kinds of things were reality. It was hardest when we lived on the commune, honestly, because part of it was a lot of people were contributing most of their money to the commune, and there was not that many people that were away working. My dad was one of them. So he ended up getting frustrated toward the end and just saying, I'm not going to be gone all the time working and contributing all this money when other grown-ups aren't. But growing up really with a struggling actor, my mom couldn't understand why I would want to do that.
Well, I know that, you know, sadly our time is up together. Thank you so much for talking with us. It was really a pleasure, and I appreciate your generosity and everything you shared with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Patricia Arquette stars in the series The Act. All 8 episodes are now streaming on Hulu. My guest, Erin Lee Carr, has written a memoir about being the daughter of David Carr, the New York Times media columnist who had a large and devoted following, including me. He died in 2015 at the age of 58 of previously undiagnosed lung cancer. The Times executive editor, Dean Baquet, described David Carr as the finest media reporter of our generation. David Carr was described in the Times as, quote, a supreme talent scout, a mentor to young reporters, and a blunt critic of those who didn't measure up, unquote. He also served as a mentor and critic for his daughter, Erin Lee Carr. She writes that her role as daughter and mentee were sometimes in conflict. David Carr wrote a memoir in 2008 about how earlier in his life he was addicted to cocaine and alcohol. He was still addicted when Erin and her twin Megan were born. Their mother, who was also addicted to crack, left soon after they were born. David knew he had to get sober. He went into recovery, putting the twins in foster care until he emerged. Erin writes about how his past affected his life and her life, and how she dealt with her own addiction to alcohol. She's now a documentary filmmaker. Her new documentary, At the Heart of Gold, premiered Friday on HBO. It's about the women who were sexually assaulted when they were young gymnasts under the care of Dr. Larry Nassar. Erin Lee Carr, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for writing your memoir. I was a great fan of your father's, and it's very interesting to hear your story and to hear about your relationship with him. I want to start by reading the quote that begins your book, a quote from your father from December 2014. And the quote is, "You know I'm not going to live forever. I won't be holed up in some hospital bed dying slowly of lung cancer. You'll be the one to put the pillow over my face, right?" So was he kidding?
I think he was half kidding and then half being very direct with me about how he wanted the end to go. And he was somebody that suffered through many, many health issues, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he was a lifelong smoker. And so he was a smart guy. I think he knew that, you know, something, he was not going to live forever, as I say. So I think that he wanted to make sure there was a member of the family that would do what needed to be done.
Why you?
I think because we were very similar. My twin is a mental health worker, so she obviously was not going to be the one to do that. And I think it would be fairly traumatic to ask your 18, 19-year-old at the time, our little sister Maddie, to do it. So I think that I was the, you know, the best possible option for the job. I guess that says something about me. I don't know if I would have. Probably not.
Well, you were very close to your father. You relied on him for advice. He helped you start your career. And you were just close. Are there things that you learned about him by talking to other people about him, by listening to other people's interviews about him, that you didn't know and that you wish you could ask him about?
I wish I could have known what he thought about the Me Too era. He raised my twin and I to be loud feminists. There's so much complication as it relates to that. And, you know, it's so fascinating being a woman in media and figuring these things out as survivors come forward. You know, I want to ask him about Trump. I want to ask him about all of these things. And yet I have to sort of work through and put the puzzle pieces together of former interviews that he did to answer present day questions.
You tell the story of when you were 8 years old and you were talking to your new friend, and it sounds like you didn't have many friends at the time, and you called your stepmother Jill. You called her by her first name. You didn't call her mom. And so your friend questioned you, like, why are you calling your mother, your stepmother, by her first name? And then you told your 8-year-old friend the story of how your father and your birth mother were drug addicts when you were born, and how your birth mother still was. And then what happened?
So after I told her that they were drug addicts, and I knew that it was sort of a dangerous word, but I thought that it was potentially a way to become closer. I thought it was like sharing a secret, you know? And so my dad, because this was such a new time in my life to have a friend over, he wanted to help me out. And so he popped his head into the room and said, "Do you want to go to McDonald's?" And of course we said yes. And so when we went out to the car and this little girl, Alex, saw that my dad was the one that was going to be driving, in a very smart way, she was like, "I'm not getting in a car with you." And I think that, you know, I immediately turned beet red. And I was like, oh, my God, I shouldn't have done that. And, you know, my dad said, "I guess we're not going." Alex's parents were called. She was picked up. And I went upstairs deeply fearful about what was going to happen next. And my dad called me downstairs to have a talk.
Yeah. And before we get to that talk, I just want to clarify, your father was no longer a drug addict at the time. Like, he was sober. Your mother still was, but she was gone. She was absent.
Right.
So what was the talk that your father gave you after you had told your friend that your parents were drug addicts when you were born and she declined to get in the car with your father?
Well, I don't think he thought that I was going to tell anybody about it. I don't know if he never said, you know, this is something to be ashamed of. But, you know, he sat my twin and I down and said, you know, this is your story. But you have to be really careful about who you tell it to. And he talked about that you can't trade it for intimacy or, you know, things like that. You know, I was a little kid, but what I understood from the conversation was that I had a very different origin story than that of other kids I knew growing up. And, like, how that made me different, I wasn't sure. I just knew that he was sober now and he was able to take care of us.
So I want to play, you write about a moment in your memoir that's a turning point in your father's life. You describe it as his moment of reckoning. And this is the moment when he realized he needed help and had to go into recovery. And it involves you and your twin sister when you were babies. So your father told this story to Dave Davies on our show when Dave interviewed your father for Fresh Air after the publication of your father's memoir, The Night of the Gun. So here's Dave Davies talking to David Carr about the incident that made him realize he needed to get sober and get help.
And when did you know that you had to do something and get yourself into a a program.
There was this night when Anna was busy. She was out somewhere, and I was at home, and I was watching the girls, and they were probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 months. And I was out of drugs, and I was not the kind of person that would leave them home, but I needed to go somewhere. So they came with me, and I left them parked in the car while I went inside for what was supposed to be 5 minutes, and probably turned out to be more like 2 hours. And when I came out, I didn't really know what I would find in that car, you know, two babies alone in a crummy part of the city, cold night, tucked in their snowsuits. And I opened up the door and I could see their breath. And I just, you know, if there's any kind of moment, that was when I just said, you know, I've been a bad husband. I had been married earlier in life. I never married Anne. I had been a bad sibling. I had been a bad son. I had been a bad employee. There was nothing really in my upbringing that suggested it'd be okay to be a bad father. I was raised well by wonderful parents, and I just got a clear feeling that I was up to something that God would not easily forgive.
So that was David Carr talking to Fresh Air's Dave Davies in 2008, and my guest is Erin Lee Carr, who's written a memoir about her life and about her relationship with her father. It's called All That You Leave Behind. So, Erin, in your father's memoir, he writes about that incident. I decided that my twin girls would be safe, that God would look after them, while I did not. When was the first time you heard that story about him leaving you and your twin as babies in a car for a couple of hours while he went and scored drugs?
When I was in high school, I knew that my dad was writing a book, and I knew it was going to be about his former life as someone who was addicted to crack. And, you know, he came upstairs, and he had this big pile of pages, and he was kind of handing it to me as if it were like a hot potato, like it was radioactive. And he said, "This is the book. I need you to look at it. You have 2 weeks. If there's anything in there that makes you horribly uncomfortable, I will take it out. But I'm gonna tell you it's rough." And maybe he had told me the snowsuit story before, but to see it written in the book in that way, you know, was a completely different experience. And it, you know, I sort of choked on the emotion. Like I thought how close I came to not being there anymore. And I think that it really made me think about his story differently.
Because he put your life at risk.
Wouldn't be the last time he would put my life at risk, you know, because of drugs and alcohol. We said something in my family that drugs explain everything and excuse nothing. And so we had to reconcile that he was still the person that left us alone. And, you know, like part of me, it's just like, why didn't you leave me at home? You know, I think that it's just like there's so much scarier things that can happen in that car. And it sort of still confounds me that I am the kid in that snowsuit. But I think that it's sort of a miracle and that we are still here. Because even our birth, like my twin and I was born 2 pounds. You know, it was grim. There was very little shot that this was going to work out. And against most odds, I'm sitting here talking to you about it.
You know, as we talk about your father, who was one of my kind of journalism heroes, I keep trying to imagine, what would he make of this conversation? Like, is anything we're saying, like if he's listening now, is anything that we're saying, my questions or your answers, like, upsetting him? So I can't imagine what you went through writing the book, asking yourself that question, probably.
It was just so cool just to hear him in the headphones in this room that we're sitting in, that he gets to be a part of this. You know, I love hearing his voice. Like, I started to tear up when I was listening to that story. And that's a very dramatic story. Like, that is not something that I'm proud of or that I like to talk about. But it's just like, just to even hear his voice, and talk about that he was raised well. And I'm like, you know what, Dad? I was raised well, too. You know, you were not a bad parent. You were a fantastic parent. And I think that, like, I can feel him sort of smiling at that. He's like, you know, like kind of like wiping the sweat off his brow and be like, don't tell them too much, but don't tell them too little. Make it interesting. He talked about life being a grand caper and that we hope it doesn't end soon. And so I think that the book is about extending the caper.
Your father had a relapse after 14 years of sobriety. So I guess that would make you around 14. So he was driving drunk with you, your twin, and your baby sister in the car. And you were very upset about this. I mean, he wasn't driving well. Like, he was swerving a lot. It worked out okay, but you were just lucky. And you were very upset. You were very angry. But by this time, you were drinking yourself. You'd started drinking. I think you'd started drinking already. You were...
No. So that happened before I ever touched alcohol. That was around 14. I took my first drink at 16.
Mm-hmm. So, and you quickly became a blackout drinker. So, like, you knew what the consequences could be. You'd seen it firsthand. You'd heard stories about it. Your father had told you about it. Did that affect you at all when you started to drink a lot?
So I have a genetic predisposition to alcohol. The first time I drank, I went back for more, and I was secretive about it, and I drank until I threw up everywhere. And so if I had, you know, my first drink led me to realize why, like, I really like this, but I like it in a way that other people don't like it. And so my sort of dalliance with alcohol was sparing at first. A couple times in high school, always to excess. And then when I got to college and it was suddenly something that was available to me, I went to a Big Ten school and there just, like, beer appeared magically in front of me, and I thought it was incredible and it was so exciting. And I always blacked out and I always felt embarrassed the next day. But I could, like, in my youth, I just shook it off. This is what happens. This is a part of being young. It's funny. You know, my friends called me Autopilot Aaron. You know, it became this sort of mantle that I wore almost proudly.
When did your father become aware of your drinking, and what did he say to you about it?
What pops out to me when you ask that was there was a screening at Gawker for Page One, A Year in the New York Times, the documentary in which my dad was in, and there was an open bar, and that was always the kiss of death with me. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. And in the middle of the Q&A, when he was answering a question, I, like, kicked over not one, but a couple of bottles of beer that I had at my feet as I was trying to leave to go to the bathroom. And I felt him. Like, I saw his withering stare. He saw it was me, and I was like, this is not going to be good. And so, you know, I had another drink because I was nervous about what was about to come next. And he took me aside and he said goodnight. And he didn't say anything. And I said, okay, like, maybe I'm imagining it. And he called me the next day and he said, you know, you're uninvited from these things. These events are not an excuse for you to embarrass me and drink yourself to a blackout. And I won't be a part of it and I won't watch it. And you're done.
What effect did that have on you?
It was like the shame that I mentioned, but cranked up to this insane volume where it drowned out all of my other thoughts. You know, I felt really unlovable. Being a part of the origin story of being these miracle babies that, you know, were able to grow up and be healthy and, like, live their own lives, I thought it was not going to go well. Like, there was going to be a turn in the story. And so I think that I just sort of, like, stayed away from him a while. And I never thought that he was wrong, though. That's the thing. I knew that what I was doing was, you know, not unforgivable by any means, but, like, you know, couldn't I have enough self-control while at a work event with my father to cool it, you know? And, like, that's the thing. No, I didn't have it. And so I drank to excess, but not around him. And, you know, it wasn't until I was fired in 2013 when he sat me down and said, you have two options in front of you. One is the path of alcoholism and insignificance. And two is you stop drinking and you see, you know, who you can become.
I'm wondering what impact it had on your drinking to go through your father's death and try to kind of survive afterwards.
So I was sober for 9 months when my father was alive. And so he got to experience a version of me as a sober person. And I, like, thank whatever God is out there that that was a part of something that he saw. And I relapsed for the most simple of reasons, that I was bored, that I was really, I was sick of staying home every single night and watching a documentary and, you know, being near my friends as they got to enjoy alcohol. And I just, like, it was just this jealousy that sort of burned me up. And I said, you know, I'm 25. I don't have alcoholism. This is just me trying to mimic my dad. Like, I can drink with moderation. And within a month of me trying alcohol again, I was found unconscious by my sister in my bedroom. And so that, to me, completely proved that I cannot be a normal drinker. And so even knowing that, as I head into his completely shocking death, I could not get through it without alcohol. And so the night he died, I drank. His funeral, I was high during. And, you know, that's I hate bringing that up, but I think that anybody who goes through loss, like, it's not like, oh, the second, you know, he was gone, I got sober, and, like, that's how this goes. Like, there's so many people that can get through the death of a parent sober, but I just was not one of them.
But you've been sober. I mean, you've been sober for, since not long after he died. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Basically, the 6 months after he died, I would have this push-pull of, should I drink? Should I not? I know that I have alcohol issues. It's called the debate society, where, you know, you're trying to figure it out. And on the six-month anniversary of his death, it was one of those nights where I could not hold it back. And I drank so much, the next day I felt like killing myself. And I just had a moment of reckoning, saying, this is not the life that my father would want me to live. And he's not here anymore, and I have to try to make him proud. And so why don't I just try to do a day without alcohol again? Okay, I'm going to try a week without it. Now I'm going to try a month. And it's that sort of age-old adage of a day at a time. But this time I took it very seriously because I was trying to work towards him, what he did. And, like, I couldn't get sober for him, but he was a part of my decision to get sober. And I've been sober since August 23rd, 2015. And it is crazy what has happened since then, once I stopped putting substances in my body. I mean, I could not have written this book if I was drinking. There's no way. I would have blown through every edit deadline imaginable.
You were very close to your father. You relied on him for advice. He helped you start your career. You were always concerned about being in his shadow or not living up to his expectations. Did his death kind of force you to figure out who you are independent of him?
You know, I think about that a lot, and it's painful that so much of my life and in making films have, it's taken place after he died and at an exponential rate. And so I think about, my boyfriend at the time said, you're always asking your dad for advice. Like, do you ever just sort of wait a beat and think about what you have to say before asking him? And I thought that was really insulting. And I was like, well, if you had access to David Carr, how could you not use it? Like, I guess that's such a weird way of putting it. But, like, just, like, being able to call him and ask him a question. I mean, he was brilliant. And, like, I would always apologize and say, like, I really don't want to waste your time. I have this quick thing. What do you think about it? But I think when I no longer had that, yeah, there was the only voice I could really listen to and trust right at that moment was myself. And so I think that he had to leave and pass away in order for me not to rely so heavily on him. But, like, I'm going to be real with you. I would have completely rather, like, him be here and me have no work. I think that, like, it is the most profound loss I will ever experience. And nothing that has happened outweighs the pain of him being gone.
What's some of the best journalism advice he gave you?
Well, he just kind of, you know, I remember when I was talking with the guy who was the cannibal cop, who was a New York City police officer who was convicted of conspiracy to kidnap, rape, torture, and eat young women. And he gave me feedback on, like, what to act like when I got inside the prison. And, you know, like, if I was feeling fearful, what to do with that. And it was always about, like, don't bring your cameras, don't bring a microphone, look somebody in the eyes and say, thank you so much for taking time out of your day for me to do my job. And I guess, like, you know, with that guy being in prison, you know, he was happy to see me. But now every time when I approach a subject, I'm not logistics. I'm not business. I am looking and staring into their eyes and figuring out, like, what the story should be. And I think that that shows up in his work.
Well, Erin Lee Carr, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. I'm so sorry you lost your father. I'm relieved that you have found, you know, your path in life and that you seem to have a really decent, well, I don't know much about your personal life now, but you certainly have a great career. And so there's that. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Erin Lee Carr is the author of the new memoir, All That You Leave Behind. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.